I'm Greg Hunter. Welcome to USAWatchdog.com. We have another new guest on, and this guest has been asked for by, I don't know, at least a dozen people on the website and on the USA Watchdog Greg Hunter YouTube channel. He is James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com, and also the YouTube channel has, you know, tens of thousands of subscribers. Very, very important work being done. James Corbett coming to us from Western Japan. Thank you for joining us today on USA Watchdog.
Well, thank you so much for having me here, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Lots to talk about, and I want to kind of talk about your latest free movie on the internet called The Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve. And one of my most recent guests, Axel Merck, who manages, you know, several hundred million dollars, he says, you know, they're not going to like me saying this. It's going to sound kind of weird. But, you know, all the stuff going on, the wars, the poverty, the crashes, the financial calamity, this is all the mostly the part of the, you know, the fault of the Federal Reserve. And I thought, wow, that's really boiling it down to one pinpoint thing. And your movie, you know, talks about how the invention of the Fed and how cloak and dagger it was and how they want you to believe that, oh, it's all boring, crazy stuff. You don't need to know about this. And, you know, ultimately one of the sound bites in the end of the movie was, you know, it's who would sign on for self-destruction, which is kind of what it is. And, you know, tell me about the idea about your movie and why you put it out and why you put it out at this time.
Well, I think that's exactly the point that you just talked about there, because it certainly occurs to me that the central banking issue and who controls the money supply really is at the root of so many of the problems that we see taking place right now, not only economically, but geopolitically, because, of course, the ability of the United States government, for example, to continue waging wars of aggression around the world is predicated on that ability to continue issuing debt in order to create more money in the economy. And of course, that has multiple different ramifications, not only the ability, of course, of the U.S. War machine to continue its work unabated, but also the devaluation of the dollar itself. And by any measure that you choose to measure the success or failure of the Federal Reserve, it is a stunning failure because it fails to live up to all of the reasons that it was supposedly created for, including, of course, ensuring the stability of the money supply and the stability of the purchasing power of the dollar, which has declined a staggering 97%. Since the creation of the Federal Reserve 100 years ago. And that's not just a function of money itself. If you look at the history of the purchasing power of the dollar long term over hundreds of years, you see a precipitous decline with the creation of the Federal Reserve, and specifically since the Second World War. So the Federal Reserve, even if we were to take it at its own face value of what it says they're supposedly trying to do, it has been a failure, and it continues to be a failure, and that failure is snowballing on itself so that the problems that it creates keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, to the point where, of course, last decade we saw the subprime mortgage meltdown and all of the craziness that was facilitated, of course, by the Federal Reserve, lowering interest rates to nearly zero and basically fueling the housing bubble. And when that burst, who ends up getting bailed out to the tune of not hundreds of billions, but literally trillions of dollars? It's the very banks that created the problem. And of course, who are the bankers who are directing the Federal Reserve's emergency lending operations to the banks? It's the directors of the banks themselves who sit on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the other important regional banks of the Federal Reserve system. So it is a system designed for and by the private banking cartel that created it and brought it into existence. And it serves their interests very well to the detriment of everybody else in the country.
Are you expecting another financial calamity coming up? You know, it's been my contention that, you know, this year would be much like 2007, that we'll get through it, but we're going to have some major calamities, major failures. And then 2015 is going to be a 2008 type year. Do you foresee some sort of calamity coming up here, another financial calamity? And is it going to be more or, you know, greater or less than the 2008 meltdown?
Well, I think that the calamity from 2008 really hasn't been solved. It's only been postponed. It's been kicked down the road by this incredible infusion of money into the economy via the quantitative easing that the Federal Reserve has been taking part in over the past several years, now to the tune of having $4 trillion on their balance books. It is an insane system that really, again, has only served to blow up another bubble, this time in the equities markets and, of course, the bond bubble itself. And once that begins to unwind, that is a process that there is no mechanism for solving through the big stick of the monetary policy that the Federal Reserve wields. Once the interest rates start getting out of control, that spells the end of the gravy train and the beginning of the hyperinflationary spiral. And I think once that point kicks in, obviously we're going to see precipitous declines in the overinflated stock market, and a lot of people who have been making nominal notional paper wealth over the last few years are going to find out what that paper really amounts to at the end of the day, which is pretty much nothing. It amounts to paper promises, and I certainly do see that. I don't have a time frame for that. There are so many different factors that have to be factored in, but recent reports from major international institutions have now pinpointed as much as $29 trillion in global investments by the large central banks, including the Federal Reserve and other large government pension funds, institutionally invested in equities markets, which are now completely blown beyond all proportions of where they should be. So we keep seeing record high after record high on the Dow Jones and the S&P, and we're told that this is supposed to be some sort of reflection of economic recovery, and it absolutely is not. What we're seeing is just the papering over of the festering wound that has been there at least for the last decade, and really is part of the institutional functioning of the Federal Reserve System at this point.
Well, wars and rumors of wars. I mean, we have Ukraine, we have the Middle East is on fire from Israel all the way over to Iran with the ISIS and Iran being involved. They're worried about ISIS or ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, or the Islamic State now, the Caliphate. And in your neck of the woods, Japan, U.S. is sending another carrier group. And, you know, Japan seems like they're ramping up their war machine. Their money printing days are winding down. And I mean, here we have another carrier group. What's your view, being you're up pretty up close and personal in Western Japan, about the situation between Japan and China and the South China Sea and the big hubbub there and the Chinese fighter flying, highway to the danger zone aerobatics around our Poseidon aircraft, basically monitoring what's going on in China. What is your perception of this increasing inching towards war, no matter where it is? And let's start with your part of the globe.
Well, it is exceptionally worrying, and you're right. I mean, the military expenditures in the Asia-Pacific region have been increasing precipitously in recent years, and have gone off the charts in the last couple of years, specifically because of Japan increasing its so-called self-defense force, and China, of course, increasing its naval power to counteract that. And we're seeing this tit-for-tat in the region, which is just a seemingly never-ending, ever-increasing cycle of military expenditures that just keep going up and up. And we see the United States having signed all sorts of pacts and agreements and commitments with Australia, with the Marines down in Darwin there, increased naval presence in the Philippines, the talk of even leasing naval ports in Vietnam and other places, all of course to combat this increasing Chinese boogeyman in the region. It is a very worrying situation, and if there is any bright spot, it's only that I think that no one at this point actually desires outright military confrontation. Every side is using this politically as a convenient way to not only rally domestic political support, but also to justify increasing expenditures. And of course, it's been the policy of Japanese Prime Minister Abe since he came into power about 2 years ago to basically inflate the money supply here in Japan, exactly as the Federal Reserve has been inflating it in the United States as part of the regional and global currency war that we see taking shape right now.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of weak hands out there. I mean, China has a big, huge, real estate market that could implode. Japan is printing money like there is no tomorrow. The U.S. Has a problem with its monetary policy. We've got trillions and 17 and a half trillion. The Europe is absolute basket case. I mean, does it look like we're in Ukraine? We got that going on. The Middle East is, stuck in some type of a war, a scenario that is increasing. It looks like we are headed towards global war, and it's because of money. What say you?
I say I completely concur with that statement. It's only a question of what shape and what form that war will take place. And we are seeing the battle lines being drawn in a lot of different ways right now. Of course, the most obvious is Russia, which is being demonized and targeted and sort of cut off from the quote-unquote international community, by which I guess we mean the United States and its allies. But we see Russia retaliating now with, for example, the food import sanctions that it's applying against the European Union and U.S. and Australia and Canada. And things are becoming quite interesting. It's very much, I think, going to be an economic conflict, or at least one that is fundamentally centered on economics. And in that regard, we see the BRICS agreements that are being signed right now, and bilateral trade among BRICS members, and the new development bank that they're creating, and the contingency reserve agreement that they just signed in Brazil. All of these things are just bricks in that wall, if you will, that are constructing an alternative system, so that we are truly moving out of the unipolar world of the U.S. hegemony towards a multipolar world. There is no doubt that that's taking place right now, and there's no doubt that that can't happen without some conflict happening. And again, it's a question of when and how that conflict eventuates, but it is on the way. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, global war.
Unfortunately so. And again, I think we are seeing the battle lines of that being drawn quite broadly right now, and we're starting to see what types of countries are going to band together against what other countries. And I think as that continues to shake out, we're going to see some surprising events. I really do think there's a lot of centripetal forces working in the European Union right now that are pushing some of the periphery away from the center of Brussels, as the certainly some of the Eastern European nations see more of their direct own common good being situated with their reliance on trade with Russia, rather than being part of some Eurozone, which itself is faltering and crashing as we speak. So I think there's going to be some interesting ways that this will play out, and probably some surprises as this continues to eventuate.
What do you think we get first? War or financial collapse? Or both of them at the same time?
Historically speaking, they tend to come in lockstep, and I wouldn't venture to speculate, but if I had to, I guess it would be I would see the financial collapse preceding the actual military confrontation and being used as a justification for that. And again, that can take place in a lot of different ways. I mean, for example, of course, we saw the events of 9/11 being used as that excuse for sort of the giant expansion of the military-industrial state after the lull in the post-Soviet era. We saw this sudden need and justification for this new military terror complex, as it were. And I think in the event of whatever type of financials collapse scenario we're going to see next is going to be the excuse and the justification for the massive expansion of another round of military interventionism.
You know, you're in Western Japan, and so you, I'm sure you speak fluent Japanese, and you have a lot of friends. You've been over there for a long time. Are they afraid? Is the Japanese population afraid of war with China, or are they, yeah, great, bring it on? I mean, give me the flavor of what's going on in Japan, because we're only seeing a smidgen of what's going on. I mean, we're sending another carrier group. Now we're going to have two carrier groups over there. So you know what message that sends? That's the big stick measure. Message. What are Japanese people saying about this escalation towards war?
I think there's an increasing polarization of Japanese society, and there is at least the growing room for expression of nationalistic sentiments and other things, which even a short time ago were very much looked down upon socially here in Japan as expressions of the old imperialist type of mindset that was responsible for the aggression in the World War I, World War II era. And that's been completely eradicated from Japanese society, very much looked down on for a very long time. But we see that rising again, and there's the old sense of nationalism and militarism that's being revived here as a result. Well, it's a chicken and egg question, whether it's being whipped up by the politicians here or whether it's happening as a result of China's growing influence in the region, or whether those two things are interlocked in a way that it's impossible to separate. Whatever the case may be, there's certainly a rising nationalist and militarist sentiment here, and it may still be a sort of relatively small hardcore of nationalist support for people like Abe, but it is growing, and there is greater room for that expression. Of course, there remains a great degree, a large percentage of the population here that's very much against that type of nationalist or militarist sentiment, but there is, I think, a growing concern over China and its growing ability to wield itself not only militarily but economically throughout the region. And we see that reflected in the fact that a lot of people here who in past years were trying to learn English and become part of the English-speaking business community are now trying to learn Chinese and increasingly taking business trips to Shanghai or Beijing or what have you. So it's definitely having an influence overall on the society here, and a lot of people are concerned about where this is heading.
I have you on, and a lot of people have asked me about Fukushima and reporting on Fukushima, and this is a godsend because I was going to just interview you about, you know, your Fed movie, which is terrific, and everybody should take a look at it. It's free on the internet on your Corbett Report YouTube channel, which is fantastic to educate people about, you know, where does money come from, but you know, actually Fed money. But you have a website also called FukushimaUpdate.com, and I was, you know, looking at this the last day or two and was shocked to find out how awful the reporting is about how, oh, the whole Western United States is covered in radiation. And you know, recent reports that the radiation is 300 meters deep and it's heading south, at least for the time being. Now, you're 400 miles away from Fukushima. It's on the eastern side of Japan. You're on the western side of Japan. But give me your update about Fukushima. How bad is it? Is it getting any better? And is it going to affect, well, the U.S. and the rest of the Western world?
Well, the answers to those questions are really dependent on the information that is forthcoming, or more to the point, not forthcoming from TEPCO, which has been blamed repeatedly throughout this entire crisis scenario for its reluctance to give basic information to the public in a timely fashion. And of course, that goes right back to the beginning of this, where they knew within 24 hours that they were dealing with meltdowns in the reactor cores, but they neglected to tell the public about that for a period of nearly 2 months. So, I mean, right from the beginning, we've had this withdrawal and withholding of basic critical information. And of course, that continues right through to today. So that, for example, there is now people who are in Japan who are suing the Japanese government to get the information from an interview or a series of interviews that was conducted with the Fukushima plant manager back in the wake of the disaster back in 2011, trying to make that public. It's been withheld by the government all this time. There are newspapers reporting that apparently his testimony includes such nuggets as the fact that as much as 90% of the plant workforce abandoned the site after being directly ordered not to during that crisis. Again, we still only have a vague understanding of exactly how the crisis played out, and that's facilitated by the government and TEPCO working in collusion to hold back basic information. So it is difficult to get a grasp on what's going on, and that's exacerbated by the fact that, for example, a lot of people in North America, especially on the West Coast, are concerned about Fukushima radiation, and that concern is not allayed by the fact that there is no U.S. Agency, no governmental agency or scientific institution that is conducting or monitoring the radiation coming from Fukushima. So this is now falling into the hands of citizen-led coalitions and groups like the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute and other sorts of groups, including one called Fukushima Inform, which is now conducting tests in the North Pacific, trying to find traces of Fukushima radiation. They're relying on a certain isotope of cesium, cesium-134, which has a 2-year half-life, so it is a pretty reliable fingerprint of Fukushima radiation as opposed to radiation from open atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons several decades ago or what have you. If they find cesium-134, that's basically a fingerprint of Fukushima. And so they're testing this to try to find out where the radioactive plume, because again, there's 300 to 400 tons of radioactive water spilling out into the ocean every day from the Fukushima plant.
So every day, right now, to this day, after all this time, 300 to 400 tons every day spilling out into the ocean, you still have reactor meltdown going on. It's not under control, I take it.
Well, it certainly isn't. I mean, it depends. Of course, they declared a cool shutdown back in December of 2011, but what does that really mean? Of course, the reactor cores have not been dealt with in any way. They remain molten in some state, but they don't even know exactly where or how they're lying, and they have no way of finding that out right now, because the technology for even approaching the reactor cores at this point does not yet exist. That's a point that's been made by many nuclear physicists, that the robots and other technology they would have to even get close enough to the reactors to find out where and how they're lying, supposedly at the bottom of the containment, let's hope, still does not exist. So again, it is just an unthinkable situation. in a lot of ways. But as you say, exactly, 300 to 400 tons of radioactive water is spilling out into the ocean every single day. So Fukushima Inform, for example, is one citizen-led coalition that's monitoring this. And they, up on their blog right now, have a post about some of the early results of, and pretty surprising results, of where this radioactivity is actually going. And although most of the models have been predicting the main thrust of that radioactive plume to be heading eastward towards the west coast of North America because of prevailing ocean currents, they're finding now that actually a lot of this radiation has gone very deep below the surface, as much as 300 meters below the surface, and 10 to 60% of it, potentially even the majority of it, as much as 60% of this radiation is heading southward, which again was not predicted by any of the models. So some kind of surprising results there. And as you say, results that aren't really being reported on reliably by much of the mainstream or alternative media at this point.
Whew, 1,000 feet deep, basically 300 meters roughly, 1,000 feet deep heading southward. That doesn't mean it couldn't end up on the west coast of America eventually. I mean, if you have unfettered 300 to 400 tons of this radioactive junk going into the water, I mean, if it keeps going, eventually it's going to contaminate just about everything in the Pacific, is it not?
Well, I mean, eventually it certainly would when we're playing this out. And of course, the reactor cores will remain radioactive for tens of thousands of years. I mean, this isn't a problem that's going to go away anytime quickly. It's just a question of whether they're in some way able to bring that radioactive water into containment in some way, or to stop it from flowing through the site. And of course, we've seen some pretty ridiculous ideas being floated in recent months, including, of course, the ice wall that they were planning to try to construct around the site to stop the groundwater running down from the mountains to the west, down through the site and out into the ocean. They were going to construct an ice wall, basically trying to create permafrost around the plants in order to stop the water from running through it. That turned out to be a dismal failure. They were unable to cool the ground enough to actually achieve the ice wall that they were attempting to achieve. So that idea has been pretty much abandoned. And they're still trying to deal with all of this radioactive water that's running through the site and the radioactive water that continues to accumulate at the bottom of the reactor cores, in the reactor buildings, etc. So they're simply trying to pump as much of it as they can into the containment facilities, the storage tanks that they've created on site, but those storage tanks themselves are leaking, so it's just disaster upon disaster, and really no long-term solution in sight yet.
This is an enormous ongoing problem, and you would never know that there was any problem at all. You know, hey, make sure you come to Japan for the 2020 Olympics. We're all groovy here. I mean, yeah. Is it illegal for you to report on this? Didn't they make some terrible laws about reporting, or did I get that wrong?
Japanese government? Yeah, last December they passed a new state secrets legislation here in Japan that will make it does make it illegal for whistleblowers to reveal what is deemed to be classified or sensitive information. So that could potentially, of course, affect something like Fukushima, where obviously the government can use the very vague language in that law to try to clamp down on any whistleblowers who attempt to get that word out to the public. And obviously that would have an effect on reporting. That hasn't been openly, or at least declared in any declared sense, used in this sense yet. But of course, the problem with a law like that is the chilling effect that it has, and the fact that it tends to prevent that type of whistleblowing before it happens, rather than clamping down on it after it happens.
Would you ever consider leaving Japan? Could it get bad enough where Japan could just be in, most of Japan be in trouble?
Well, certainly if the reactor cores do breach containment and start getting into the groundwater and literally spreading throughout Japan, I mean, obviously that's going to be a huge problem. At this point, the Fukushima area and the Fukushima region is a huge concern, and there does need to be, and there is at any rate at the moment, ongoing testing, for example, among children in Fukushima for thyroid cancer. So far, they've found 104 documented cases, 57 of which were confirmed cancer and 46 suspected, and there's a couple in there that I think were somewhere in between, but it's unclear whether or not yet that's actually above the usual rate of 30 cases per 100,000. But we wouldn't expect thyroid cancer to start really climbing until 4 years after the disaster. So really, until next year, we would not expect to see the flood of thyroid cancer cases. So there is, I mean, obviously ongoing concern there. There's still even the just the basic issue of the 18-kilometer exclusion zone around the Fukushima plant, which has displaced over 100,000 people and continues to displace many families, and some of the devastating effects that have taken place in those families, many of them being split up and sent in different to different parts of the country, many of them living in pretty poor conditions and being promised, in some cases, some type of compensation from TEPCO that is taking years to arrive and requires jumping through all sorts of bureaucratic hoops. And then there's the economic effects of this disaster, of course, occurring in the part of the industrial and agricultural heartland of Japan. I mean, there's a lot of problems that this has created in a lot of different ways that are not going to be papered over by just Bank of Japan money printing, as much as Abe and his government would like to believe so.
James Corbett, CorbettReport.com. That's your website, your YouTube channel. It's the Corbett Report, correct?
That's right, yeah.
And then your movie is on there about the Federal Reserve, which is very insightful, and FukushimaUpdate.com. I really appreciate you coming on today and taking us to school from halfway around the world here on USA Watchdog. Thank you very much, James Corbett.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.